what's our unique offer? It's Aboriginal culture. And I think it's going to be even more relevant when we get past this stage, because people have started to want to go back to basics.
G'day and welcome to the Clean State WA podcast. My name's Anthony James from the Regeneration podcast. On board with you here for this special series dedicated to our home state of Western Australia and the newly released Clean State Jobs Plan. How can we build back better from the coronavirus, avert climate catastrophe, and transition to a regenerative, fair and prosperous Western Australia? I speak here with the West Australians getting it done, the thousands of jobs being created, the success being achieved, and the enormous opportunities that await.
I'm Dale Tilbrook and I'm a co-owner of Mullinup Aboriginal Gallery with my brother Lyle. I'm a Wardundi Bibbulmun woman and I've been working here in the Swan Valley, particularly with Aboriginal art and bush foods for the last 25 years.
Today it's my privilege to speak with a much-loved native food specialist, educator and passionate Aboriginal tourism advocate. Like a lot of Australia this week, Dale's immersed in NAIDOC Week, celebrating the history, culture and achievements of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. She also continues to work towards a big vision for First Nations people and WA as a whole. This vision is reflected in the joint proposal made by Clean State WA and the influential WATOC, the Western Australian Indigenous Tourism Operators Council. Dale's seen WATOC generate a litany of outstanding success stories in Aboriginal tourism and at times with very few resources. The potential is huge, she says, with the right support and investment to empower Aboriginal communities with all sorts of flow-on benefits and at a time when WA and the rest of the world need it most. Dale was kind enough to invite me to the gallery for this conversation. Can you explain where we are to the listeners and why it's special to you?
We're in the Swan Valley, which is still in the Perth metropolitan area, and it's a wine-growing area. It's the oldest wine-growing area in the state. It's become special to me. It wasn't special to me when I first came here. It was just really convenient because we were offered a really good workshop for our boomerang-making business at the time. But that boomerang making business soon expanded and we added a small gallery, and then we started getting requests to do things for busloads of tourists. So we started flying returning boomerangs and playing didgeridoo for people, and like Topsy it grew. When we first started, you know, people came along and said, we'll bring you a busload of tourists and you can do all this entertaining for us, and they never offered to pay us for doing any of this. They told us how lucky we were that they were coming to us.
How
and we
interesting.
Fell for it. But over time, and I have to thank the foundation of WATOC for this, and I was a foundation board member and part of the committee before WATOC came into existence, and this was just after the Sydney Olympics. And we'd had some success with the Sydney Olympics because we got a little swing tag from SOCOG for our boomerangs, which was a great thing for a little boomerang maker in the Swan Valley.
Indeed, amazing.
It was a real coup for us. Mm. But the advent into tourism came from all of this, and we suddenly realised we were in the tourism industry. And WATOC had conferences and wonderful guest speakers and breakout sessions and workshops, and my eyes were opened. You know, I had an introduction to the tourism industry and how it should operate, and I just kept learning from there. And now I would say I'm probably one of the people in the Swan Valley who really understands tourism and the tourism distribution channels.
So what does that mean?
Tourism distribution means how do you get your customers and who are your customers and where do they come from? And getting in touch with those buyers, the inbound tour operators and the wholesalers, is not an easy thing. It's not like you just go and look up on the internet inbound tour operators and say, look, I've got this great product and I want you to sell it for me. You have to be able to meet them, and they have to be able to see that you are a real business, that you're not a fly-by-night operator, that you're here for the long term, because they're working often 2 or 3 years out.
Yeah. So relationships and trust are
relationships key. And trust are everything. And it's a very scary thing when you're not used to it.
Pressure's
on. I can never remember. The pressure is definitely on.
So you're really operating across a full gamut of supply chains.
Absolutely.
Within that tourism scene, Indigenous tourism is talked about as a growth industry. And in fact, the statistic which was fascinating to read, that 80% of incoming travellers to WA are looking for an Indigenous travel experience of some kind, but only 20% actually access one. And that's to say nothing of the locals. So has there been a shift in this appetite for engagement with First Nations people?
I think there's always been an appetite, but I hate that statistic.
Yeah, really? Tell us why.
I believe that statistic is skewed because it's an exit interview. You know, if they'd asked people coming in, you know, without asking a leading question, would they get the same answers? I don't think so.
You think it's a much lower, coming in, it's a much lower interest level?
Yes, I think, and I think if you ask the leading question, if you ask somebody coming in, would you like to have an Aboriginal tourism experience, they probably would say, oh yes, can I do that? And if you ask people going out, did you have one? No. Would you have liked to have had one? Oh yes. It's damned lies and statistics.
Yes.
Yeah, so I've never been happy with that 80-20 statistic, because there were a lot of tourism operators. There have always been quite a few burgeoning or emerging Aboriginal tourism operators in Western Australia, and I've seen them start and I've seen them stop.
Hmm.
Because it's not as simple as being there. And it comes back to what I said about tourism and Who are my customers? Where do they come from? And how am I going to get them? So all credit to WATOC and the West Australian government, because over the last few years there's been a real focus on building tourism capacity. I mean, never enough money spent, but there has been some money spent and lots of success stories. So if you take an emerging tourism operator and mentor them and, you know, give them a little bit of financial support to get the things that they really need, it may be some marketing, or it may be a bus, or it may be computer systems. Not many buses. Nobody ever wants to buy anybody a bus, because they're too easy to be the asset that got away.
Yeah.
But, you know, assist people to get the things that they need and then put them into those distribution channels. So you need to give people a real help. If you want that industry to be vibrant and growing and have lots of participants, it's going to take years and years and years if you don't actually give it a helping hand.
And you said the success stories have been numerous, and I read some. I know what you're saying, but let's talk about it here a bit. What comes off the top of the head?
Well, there's a company called Go Cultural, and they're doing tours in the city, and they're expanding all the time. They do tours at King's Park, and they do tours at Rottnest, and one of the girls of the family is starting to do hiking tours up here at Wallyanga, and they won so many tourism awards just straight out of the box. So, you know, they had all the right things right at the right times, and they wrote good applications to these tourism awards.
So it didn't come out of nowhere. They got the support you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If they had tried to do what they managed to do on their own, they wouldn't have got there. They just wouldn't have got there. Not because they didn't try hard or didn't have the talent. It's because it's just hard. if you don't know the tourism industry.
Yeah. And so the potential, damn lies and statistics aside, the potential, how are you seeing it, the potential for First Nations tourism in particular?
Oh, huge. I mean, it's just and still a largely untapped resource. When you think about the competition there's going to be for long-haul travel, if we ever get back to that world again, everybody's got beautiful beaches, everybody's got great food and wine, but what's our unique offer? It's Aboriginal culture, Aboriginal history, you know, dance performance, you know, just simple things like that are what people want to see and experience. And I think it's going to be even more relevant when we get past this stage, because people have started to want to go back to basics.
Yes.
And they want to connect with Indigenous cultures and try to understand what that lesson is from Indigenous cultures.
For how long have you seen that emerging?
Well, you know, I'm part of the slow food movement as well. So it's always been in my, you know, peripheral vision. And, you know, I love listening to Carlos Petrini speak. I heard him in, I think it was 2016 at Terra Madre, talking about the world marching towards the abyss, and at the front are the big corporations, you know, the ones like Monsanto with their lovely seeds, et cetera, and, you know, followed by the corporations and the greedy, and then it sort of came down the line, and the very last people on this line marching towards the abyss are the poor Indigenous women. And he said, when we get to the edge of the abyss and we don't want to go there, we want to turn round and go back, who will lead the way? It will be the poor Indigenous women, because they are the keepers of the seeds and the knowledge of the land. So I think that's the lesson that everybody is taking on board in some way, shape or form during this period of time. And it's obvious that it was in everybody's mind when every vegetable seed and every vegetable seedling disappeared off the shelves in a flash. Self-sufficiency was like, this might be real.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, given that those poor Indigenous women, they're still the backbone of food supply around the world today, even in that corporate context.
Yes.
So it's no surprise where we're looking. So in that COVID context, this immediate context, it's shaken tourism, of course.
Yes, for us, we relied very heavily on our interstate and international visitors, you know, and we were good little trainees in the tourism industry, because people said, focus on China, that's a huge market. So we'd been out there courting the Chinese ITOs as well. And, you know, we'd caught the attention of three, and they were bringing groups into us, and some of them for the first time in the first half of this year, all cancelled. And given our relationship with China now, you're thinking, was that really wise? Maybe we should have just concentrated on, you know, our old markets, UK and other Europe, and the parts of Southeast Asia that love us still.
And I guess local too. Is it a big part of what you try and tap into?
Well, yes, we've always had a good, steady stream of locals through our business for different reasons. People come to us for gifts, and, you know, not just local gifts, but gifts to send overseas. People come to us for food. So we have a very small catering business. We've never advertised it. If you find out about our catering, it's word of mouth.
And it's amazing. No wonder word of mouth spreads.
We don't really have the capacity to be very big.
Yeah.
But we are involved with another company, and we, big occasions, we will refer to them, and I'm their native food specialist as well. So help them integrate native food into their catering office as well.
And is that part of your thinking too? Because I know it's a part of a lot of an increasing amount of people's thinking, to not worry about that massive scale, actually stay connected to a human scale, if you like, and then help others come up in their areas.
Absolutely. We did have a much bigger business once, and we employed a lot of people, especially when we were doing boomerang making and other, you know, we used to go out to schools. We had a whole team we used to take out to schools with us. And that was in the days when NAIDOC used to be a bit of a one-day wonder.
Mm.
And we'd go into a school for a whole day and do programs for the whole school. And it was mind-blowing and exhausting.
Yeah.
But we changed and schools changed. You know, they tend to want something a bit more specialised now, a bit more specific. And that suits us because we like being a much smaller business and, you know, relying on our knowledge rather than, you know, sort of the putting on the show.
Yes. Now, this is exactly where I want to go to next, actually, Dale, around the meaning of tourism, like what it's for, aside from, yeah, a show or just a novelty. Because you can't be talking about a novelty with the oldest living culture on the planet. So
no, and the early days of tourism was very much, you know, we want to see somebody play a didgeridoo.
Yeah.
And we'd say, well, didgeridoos aren't part of our culture here, but we want to see somebody play a didgeridoo.
Yes.
Okay. And there was, you know, that very superficial appreciation of culture. But over the years, I guess we've, you know, sort of stuck to our guns a little bit more, got more confident about saying, oh, no, this is what we do, but if that's what you want, then you can go and see these people or those people. So we don't even sell didgeridoos here anymore because there's no one local making them. And I don't see the point of getting them in from Queensland or the Northern Territory and, God forbid, Bali.
Yeah.
There should be a law against it coming into this country. There really should. Yeah. There really should be a law against it coming into this country because it's not real and it actually takes away from Aboriginal people making a living out of doing something around culture because there's too much fake stuff out there and it's so cheap.
Yes.
You know, $3 boomerang. That's not a boomerang.
Yes.
That's a bent piece of wood painted by somebody who got paid nothing somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly, a whole other kettle of fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when we talk about coming out of COVID then and the potential for First Nations tourism in WA, what really sings to you?
Well, I think there's going to be lots of opportunity for people to develop many more products on country. People do want to go out on country and they do want to listen to stories. They want to feel as though they're being given access to something special, something they didn't know before. So I think that is our big opportunity. And also the development of real Aboriginal gifts and souvenirs, you know, things that are made by Aboriginal people, not made in China.
I'm so resonating to what you're saying about the appetite for these experiences to be meaningful connections with people and country, and that's what we're after. What place does food have in it?
Well, food is what we all need to survive, but there's food and then there's food.
Yes.
You know, I've eaten some pretty horrible food in my time. For us, sharing information about food is really sharing our connection to country as well. So I like to delve into the history of our food, what we did with it, how we would approach it. You know, like everybody wants yulk at the moment. It's called a bush potato or a native radish or, you know, and it's actually part of the carrot family. So it's a native carrot. And it is crisp and crunchy. It stays crisp and crunchy when you cook it. And it's sort of has a flavour profile somewhere between carrot and nashi pear. So it's really yummy. But I don't want to talk about just yulk being that really yummy food. I like to talk about how our women harvested this in a really sustainable way, that they would approach this plant and they would dig one side and harvest the tubers from one side and then fill in the hole.
Mm.
So the plant would recover and regrow the tubers on that side. And then a couple of years later, you can come along and harvest the tubers from the other side and then fill in the hole again. So that lesson in sustainability never fails to imprint itself on people who are listening to that story. You know, it's lots of aha moments. It's like,
yes,
you didn't just pull it all up. No, we saved it.
So you've dived straight into that connection with art and storytelling. They're inseparable, really.
Yes.
And that's the punchline, really, for a lot of these opportunities in First Nations tourism.
Yes, it's that connection to country. Everything comes back to connection to country. And people love hearing something that is genuine, that is authentic, that's backed by the passion of the storyteller. And we're all storytellers. We can't help be storytellers because that's who we are. And I think that's the greatest gift that we have to offer the rest of the world are our stories. And it doesn't matter what you're telling a story about. I could be telling a story about a waterhole. I could be telling a story about a vegetable. I could be telling a story about a feature in the landscape. We have a story for everything.
I was so struck and I loved seeing that Robert Taylor from Waitok said, this is culturalisation above commercialisation. The meaning and the potential for Western Australia and societies everywhere to connect in this way is huge, and we'll talk to that a bit. The economic potential is also not quite understood, I don't think, and what that means in terms of the word you used before, livelihood, autonomy and empowerment.
Absolutely. We want a hand up. We don't want a hand out. And this is what the Waitok programs have been geared to do, to reach out to those people who want to do this, because you can't go somewhere and say to people, this is a great opportunity for you, you should go into tourism. Never works. Never works. If they have got the passion and the idea and are burning to do this, then go in there and help them, and big time and seriously, because you will get out of it a great tourism product. You will get out of it people who are in business for themselves and having the opportunity to employ other people and bring wealth into their family and into their whole group.
Which can then spawn other things.
Absolutely.
Once they've got the skills and then that wealth, they've got a leg up.
It is. It is. It's amazing the difference it can make to a community when it works. But again, you have to work with the grassroots. You don't want to be, you know, top down ever. If it's there and the interest is there, help it to bubble to the surface. Don't go and tell people what to do.
So the scale of return can be massive in that sense, because then you start talking about all the things that cost a lot of money for governments as well as the communities, that they start to be alleviated. It's a win-win on both ends of the spectrum.
Absolutely. I mean, and that empowerment that spreads through the community, employment, starting businesses, it happens in other industries as well, and people spark off each other.
In terms of the Waitok Clean State joint proposal then to government right now, $200 to $400 million of investment to reap these sorts of benefits, I mean, that's not a massive investment to start with for the things we're talking about, but many parts of it are actually very small investments, small fractions of that total amount for enormous returns, and the total amount then relates to other bigger item things. And I wonder what you might say about those. Like, I was actually intrigued. I didn't know that an Indigenous cultural centre proposed for Perth was actually originally proposed to be at Elizabeth Quay when that was done.
Yes, I went to some of those meetings.
No doubt you did. And then to have five regional ones around WA, with that being at the heartland, the gateway, if you like, does that still feel like a really enticing prospect?
Well, I suppose I'm a bit jaded because I've heard it all before. And I suppose over time my vision for what that could be has changed as well.
In what ways?
Well, to start with, you always want something that draws attention to Aboriginal culture and, you know, to have a central place for people to go. And a few years ago, I did a project with the City of Swan because they wanted a cultural centre here. And, you know, you use that word gateway. That's exactly the word that I used, gateway. And that really is how I would like to see a cultural centre, not to try to do everything spot, but to celebrate what's right there in front of you and then those ever-widening circles taking people out to other countries and other experiences. And I think it's time to make use of technology as well, because you can do so much in the virtual world and you can really entice people to go and experience it themselves by giving them a taste through technology.
And then you wonder if connecting all this to more sustainable transport models and infrastructure, renewable energy embedded in that infrastructure, you can start to see how it gets to be an interconnected transition.
Yeah. And, you know, Tourism Western Australia had a separate thing that they were doing called Camping with Custodians. And that, always a bone of contention because we always felt it should belong to WATOC, but they did a fabulous job. But there's only very few sites that got to benefit from that. But where they've done it, it's been an amazing transformation for local people. And they've become important stops on people's journeys through country. So, you know, places where you can go and literally camp with the custodians, where you can have that daily interaction with local Aboriginal people, where you can engage with them, they can take you out to tours on country, you're going to shop in their shops, so you're putting more money into the local economy. It's a win-win on so many levels, and there are so many more opportunities to do things like that all over Western Australia. If we have real money, we can do real things.
Do you carry a vision? Are you animated by a vision for what Western Australia could be?
Oh, yes, and I think WATOC is a good example. You know, we have hung in there and we are still the only state where someone like or something like WATOC exists and carries on real, meaningful work to build for the future. So I just get excited about this happening, not just in the tourism industry, but the bush food industry and other industries that exist out there where having Aboriginal people involved is going to change that industry, like the mining industry.
Mm. You know, what do you imagine there?
Well, I imagine that if we truly engage with Aboriginal people and allow more Aboriginal people to benefit from the mining industry. We're not going to make the mining industry go away. That's not going to happen. But if it's more guided by Aboriginal principles, we might get better outcomes.
Thank you so very much, Dale. It's been an absolute privilege to be here with you. Thanks for speaking with me.
It's a great pleasure myself.
That was Dale Tilbrook, co-founder of the Mullen Up Aboriginal Gallery in the Swan Valley. For more on Dale and the gallery, WATOC, NAIDOC Week celebrations, Clean State WA, and how you can support the Jobs Plan or get involved with climate initiatives and other action in your community, see the links in the show notes. And of course, to hear the rest of this series, subscribe to the Clean State podcast on your favourite app or head to the Clean State website. The music you're hearing is by Selfless Orchestra, an emergence of WA musicians inspired by issues of social and environmental justice. My name's Anthony James. Thanks for listening.